I suspect today's program will be an educational experience for many of us, since we will be hearing about an area of the world we don't know much about. That area is the continent of Africa, which most experts consider the birthplace of what we now know as the human species. The second largest continent, Africa, is home to 54 separate nations and around 1.1 billion people speaking over 2,000 languages. Over 50% of Africans are under the age of 25, and the continent's population is expected to more than double to 2.3 billion people by the year 2050. Despite enormous wealth and natural resources, the growing population struggles to be self-sustaining. Over 240 million Africans suffer from chronic undernourishment. Per capita income varies from $36,000 per year in Equatorial Guinea to $300,000 in Burundi, according to the 2010 figures. Today, our special guest, George Ayeti, is here to offer his perspectives on Africa, especially his view that Africa remains poor because it is not free. George is president of Free American Foundation in Washington. He is also a professor at American University and associate scholar at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. The Foreign Policy Journal in 2008 named him one of top 100 public intellectuals who are shaping our times. We are very grateful to the Liberty Fund for their support in today's presentation by one of the leading proponents of the new reforms in Africa.
Thank you very much for the wonderful introduction. And I also would like to thank you for finding some time to come and listen to me. And I must apologize. You know, excuse my condition. I had, you know, surgery about a month ago, and I'm doing some therapy. But other than that, most of the time I'm on my feet throwing bombs. But Africa is a continent which breaks my heart. And it's difficult to convey this particular emotion to you because coming from there and knowing the wealth of the continent, I mean, you name the mineral and you find it in Africa, gold, diamond, platinum, titanium, they're all there in Africa. But the mineral wealth of Africa is not being utilized to lift its people out of poverty. And, you know, in the independence period, after independence, there's so many countries, so many people, so many organizations have come to Africa and tried to lift that continent out of its economic miasma. It's not that Africa was ignored. Yes, Africa received a lot of aid. And I'll be talking about this because the Western countries pumped more than $600 billion in aid into Africa since 1960. But there's little to show for it, except a multitude of black elephants and show hospitals, airports, and decayed infrastructure. Where did all that money go to? Now, this is what I would like to address this afternoon. First of all, I like to make some distinctions. There are three different types of aid. There is humanitarian relief aid. This is what is sent to victims of earthquakes, cyclones, and you may remember that President Obama is spending $600 million to send 3,000 U.S. troops to Liberia and Sierra Leone to help fight Ebola. And that kind of humanitarian relief assistance is difficult to quibble about. I mean, it's sort of based on our moral principles that, you know, we should help somebody in need. And the U.S. has also been helpful in sending relief aid to Darfur, Sudan, you may remember. And also President Bush came up with another aid initiative called PEPSTAR. This is the president's emergency relief aid for AIDS. And it was also very highly successful. as well as anti-malarial programs that the Bush administration has set up. As a matter of fact, the island of Zanzibar has been rid of malaria because of the efforts by President Bush. You know, so there's very little to quibble about when you talk about humanitarian relief aid. And there's also little to talk about, quibble about as far as, you know, sending U.S. troops to combat Ebola in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. But, you know, if you think about it, you know, you have to ask yourself, couldn't these diseases be prevented? Now, if you look at the history of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, those countries have been subjected to military rule and decades of corruption, which has led to the erosion and total collapse of their healthcare system. This was one of the reasons why the Ebola virus spiraled completely out of control. Because the healthcare system in those countries had literally collapsed. Why did they collapse? They collapsed because of corruption. If you look at Liberia, for example, the former president of Liberia, Charles Taylor, is right now in a jail in the UK for 50 years for crimes against humanity. Amassed a personal fortune of $5 billion. $5 billion. Now, to put that in perspective, the Atlantic Monthly, back in May 2010, compiled the net worth of all 43 U.S. presidents from Washington to Obama. And the total net worth of all U.S. presidents came up to $2.7 billion. Which meant that Charles Taylor stole more than the net worth of all U.S. presidents combined. Charles Taylor was not alone. He had Abacha of Nigeria. He looted $5 billion. Babangida of Nigeria, $12 billion. And they have Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, $42 billion. And they have been, we're talking about a poor continent, and yet we have leaders of these continents which have amassed huge amounts of personal fortune. But anyway, I don't want to be divert away from my topic. Let me come back to my topic. That is humanitarian relief aid. And the humanitarian relief aid that we have in Liberia and Sierra Leone to combat Ebola, it's noble. But then, if we had a strong healthcare system, we could have at least minimized the impact it has had in West Africa. Now, the second type of aid is military aid. Now, you can make the case for military aid and say that, okay, the U.S. is fighting this war against terrorism, and therefore there are allies that need to be armed. But then, the military in Africa has become the most discredited institution. Almost all the collapsed states in Africa, Rwanda, Somalia, Liberia, Sierra Leone, all of them, they were ruined by military regimes. And therefore, people tend to be very, very uneasy about having the military play a very important role in African affairs. In fact, giving military aid to African governments quite often happens to be very, very unsavory because the regime tends to use the military aid against its own people. A very dramatic example of this happened in Egypt. When the Egyptians rose up to demand that Hosni Mubarak step down from power, what Hosni Mubarak did was to buzz Tahrir Square with F-15s and also to send Abraham tanks to try and frighten those, intimidate those protesters. Now, where did he get the weapons from? Of course, he got the weapons from, you know, the U.S. gives Egypt about $1 billion in military aid. But then that military aid at that particular time was used against the street protesters. And therefore, military aid is one of those types of aid that has been used to suppress the people of Africa. The last type of aid is what is called official development assistance, or ODA. That is what most economists call economic aid, economic development assistance. A lot of that went into Africa, and you know, it dates back to the 1960s, where the logic for independence was the fact that the colonialists never really developed their colonies. And therefore, the African governments, after independence, decided that they were going to develop Africa in Africa's own image, not in the image of Europe. And for that to happen, they felt that the governments need to take a commanding role, an important role in shaping the destiny of their various countries. And I think that is where things started to go wrong, because the state at that time took a very strong interest and strong participatory role in determining development. And they argued that back then, that Africa didn't have the resources to develop the continent, and therefore they needed aid from the rich countries. And the rich countries responded. Now let me give you some statistics. And that statistics is, in 1960, the total population of Africa was only 12% of the entire world. And yet Africa was receiving 20% of all development aid in 1960. Now this went up to 22% in 1980. So Africa was not ignored. Africa was not neglected. Africa received a lot of aid. But then, the consensus in Washington right now is that all that aid, more than $600 billion, was not effective in lifting African people out of poverty. It wasn't effective. As a matter of fact, in 1989, the late director of USAID was called Alan Wood. He said that the U.S. is giving more than $400 billion to developing countries between 1960 and 1980, and none of them was able to graduate from developing to a developed status. None of them. And that meant that $400 billion in U.S. taxpayers' money was just wasted. And then, in 1993, in fact, USAID also did another study and said that 70 countries which were all receiving aid could not account for that aid between 1968 and 1980. The United Nations also did a study. In fact, we have studies upon studies upon studies showing that most of the American aid that was given to developing countries, especially those in Africa, were simply not effective. As a matter of fact, there were some individual countries like Chad, Burundi, Somalia, Mozambique, Tanzania. Let me take Somalia, for example. Somalia received so much aid that it was called the graveyard of aid. And yet it collapsed into civil war in 1991. As a matter of fact, the top recipients of U.S. aid in Africa, Liberia, Somalia, Burundi, all collapsed into anarchy. Now, if you look at Tanzania also received a lot of aid from Scandinavia, more than $10 billion. But then the World Bank noticed that after all this aid being poured into Africa, the average standard of living for the Africans declined by 1.2% from 1960 to 1980. So the consensus is that aid to Africa failed to achieve its objectives. And USAID knew it. American governments knew it. So what went wrong? And what could have been done to fix it? Now, there is plenty of blame to go around. First of all, there's plenty of blame on the donor side and also plenty of blame on the recipient side. Now, let me quickly go through some of these reasons why aid was not effective. On the donor side, first of all, there was a multiplicity of objectives. You know, when you give aid, the donors wanted, you know, aid to be used to promote democracy, free markets, to, human rights. So many objectives. You can't have that. If you have four objectives, at least you gotta have four instruments. So you have so many objectives which were conflicting with one another. The second problem was that you had red tape. As a matter of fact, you know, the Clinton administration in 1993 said that the U.S. aid programs were so encrusted in red tape that it was even making it difficult for the aid programs to achieve the objectives. Let me give you one example. In 2000, there were floods in Mozambique, and USAID decided to help. But then by the time the relief aid got to Mozambique, the floods were already over. It took that long. And sometimes the donors did not exercise prudence or exercise poor judgment in funding the various aid programs. Here's one example. The Canadians built a modern automated bakery in Tanzania, but quite often there was no flour to make bread. So that program was totally useless. The Italians also helped Somalia build a banana boxing plant. But to make that plant break even, you needed more than the country's total output of bananas. The U.S. also made some blunders. It built crop silos for the peasant farmers in Senegal, but then placed them in locations where the peasant farmers never visited. There was one particular project in Mali. I personally went and saw it. USAID thought they could help the Malian farmers by building internet stations in the rural areas. So it did so. Any peasant farmer who wanted to access to the internet had to pay $1 and go into some kind of a village hut and then access the internet. But then there was no electricity to charge up the internet stations. Total waste. And then there was, this is my favorite. The Norwegians went to Kenya and they said they were going to help the Turkana tribes people. So they built a fish freezing plant for the Turkana tribes people. The idea was that, the fish will be taken to Nairobi to be sold, and that would generate employment and create jobs for the Turkana tribes people. The fish freezing plant cost $25 million. When it was completed, they called the president, they called the newsmen, they even brought in the village brass band, and they cut the ribbon to open up the plant. But then they discovered a very small problem, and that problem was that the Turkana tribes people, they don't fish. They raise goats, Mary. You can multiply these blunders, you know, in the sense that, look, if you want to help American farmers, you ask American farmers what type of aid they want. Nobody asks the African people what type of aid they wanted. It was all drawn up in metropolitan centers and dumped into their labs. And this is one of the reasons why so much waste in aid occurred in Africa. And then there were also what I might call Western duplicity. Duplicity in the sense that the donors knew that some of the aid money was being stolen. I mean, if you look at the Philippines, for example, Marcos, for example, was skimming the top of the aid money to become very rich. You know, he amassed a personal fortune of $12 billion. Mobutu in Africa was also doing the same thing. Amassed a personal fortune of $10 billion. His fortune alone exceeded his country's foreign debt of $7 billion, which meant that he could have written a check to pay off his country's entire foreign debt, and then some. The World Bank knew, USAID knew, but then you couldn't talk about, the World Bank didn't want to talk about corruption because they felt that it was too sensitive, politically sensitive. In fact, Paul Wolfowitz was one of the president of the World Bank who tried to clean up the World Bank and go after corrupt African dictators. But then, you know, he was ruffling feathers too much, you know, so they kicked him out of the place in 2005. So in other words, the donors knew that the aid money was being wasted, and yet they did nothing about it. Now, let me talk a little bit about the recipient side. The recipient side, you know, in terms of African governments, I mean, there's nothing wrong with wanting to borrow money and using that borrowed money on something productive and then to generate a return and use that income to pay back the loan. There's nothing wrong with that. But in many cases in Africa, they took the loans and then consumed it. Consumed it in the sense that they took the loans and used the loans to pay civil servants' salaries. If you take a loan and use that to pay civil servants' salaries, you're not using the loan productively. The same thing happened when they took their loans and used their loans to purchase weapons or arms to fight civil wars. All that money was consumed. The second part was they used the loans to set up inefficient state-owned enterprises. Those state-owned enterprises were supposed to save foreign exchange, but they didn't. And the worst part of this was that African governments did not have the capacity or the commitment to reform their economies. The Clinton administration saw that all this effort to help Africa would come to naught if the African leaders were not willing to reform their economies and so forth. In fact, the Clinton administration came up with AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which simply said that if African governments were willing to reform their economic and political systems, the U.S. will open its markets for them so that they can come and invest or sell their goods here in the U.S. But that didn't go very far. The Bush administration came with the Millennium Challenge account. Now, that account said, okay, look, we're not going to give you aid as is normally done. We're simply going to give you grants. If you are doing the following things, number one, ruling justly and promoting economic freedom, and number three, investing in people. That too did not go very well. In other words, the U.S. administrations knew that there was something wrong with the aid programs. They tried to fix it, but the fixes were worse than the problems. Let me give you an example about the Bush administration. The Bush administration, you know, theoretically, you can't question it because it was performance-based. Bush administration said, okay, look, if you demonstrate that you're using funds effectively, we'll give you a grant. But there was one particular country, Tanzania, which did not qualify. So the Bush administration, the MCA, gave Tanzania $11 million to help it qualify for a bigger grant. The bigger grant was $598 million. All right, so Tanzania got that $11 million to clean up its act. And then President Bush went to Tanzania in 2008. Guess what happened? When he got there, the entire cabinet in Tanzania had been dissolved over a corruption scandal. Now, this was a country which had gotten $598 million in grant. And worse, the anti-corruption czar himself was implicated in a corruption scandal. Now, the point is, you can only help a country if the leadership is willing to reform. But the leadership has not been willing to reform. Ask them to develop their economies and they will develop their pocket. Ask them to seek foreign investment and they will seek a foreign country to invest the loot. Ask them to cut government spending and bloated bureaucracies and they will set up a ministry of less government spending. This is exactly what happened in Mali. Ask them to improve governance and Tanzania set up a ministry of good governance. Ask them to place more emphasis on the private sector. And Ghana set up a ministry of private sector development. In other words, the leadership and the governments have not been willing to set up and to clean up their economies or the political systems. And because of this, you have 54 African countries. Of the 54 African countries, only 13 of them are democratic. Now, back in 1990, only four were democratic. So from 1990 to 2014, that means that we've only had nine countries, democratic countries. If we go at this pace, by the time we fully democratize Africa, it will take us almost more than a century. So, what do we do? A lot of aid has been pumped into Africa, but with very little results. Should we continue doing so? Albert Einstein once said, insanity is defined as doing the same thing over and over and over and over again and expecting different results. I define lunacy as doing the same foolish thing again and again and again and expecting the same foolish results. We've pumped so much money into Africa with very little resource. You see, and this is what gets my goat. Africa really doesn't need aid. Africa has a bucket which leaks. The total amount of foreign aid that goes into Africa from all sources amounts to $35 billion a year. So we're putting $35 billion into a bucket. But the bucket leaks. What are the leakages? Corruption alone costs Africa $148 billion a year. Corruption. Now, put that aside and then take a look at food imports. Africa used to be able to feed itself back in the 1960s. Not anymore. It's now wasting a lot of foreign exchange to import food. How much? $25 billion a year. And then we have capital flight, money which is leaving Africa, $80 billion. If you add up all those leakages, He had far more money, much more money than the 35 billion, poor 35 billion that comes into Africa as foreign aid. Now, in 2000, I thought when 2008, when President Obama came to power, I felt that finally we're going to have a leader who is going to be tough on African governments. As a matter of fact, in 2009, I met with Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. And I give her credit for it. You know, she was going on a seven-nation African tour, and she had assembled a few African experts she wanted to sort of bounce some ideas off. And when I met with her, she says, "All right, okay, George, what do you think the U.S. should do to help Africa?" And I told her that the U.S. doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. What the U.S. should do in Africa is exactly what the U.S. did to the former Soviet Union, help the collapse of the former Soviet Union. And what did the U.S. do? What the U.S. did was to establish Radio Free Europe. And I said, if the U.S. were to set up Radio Free Africa, that would be, you know, Americans take the media for granted, but the media is a life and death of broadcasting in Africa. Africans can speak their mind. Africans know what their problems are, but they can't speak it. Now that's what I told Mrs. Clinton. Now whether she followed up on that is a totally different thing, and I doubt whether the State Department would follow up on that, because you know they have so many other objectives that they have to follow. But the point that I wanted to emphasize was that for far too long, the U.S. foreign policy towards Africa had been leader-centered, and it is not centered on institutions. Institutions such as the free media, institutions such as an independent judiciary. If we were to focus on these, then we'll be able to bring about change. You know, the change in Africa has to come from the Africans themselves. The U.S. can only help. The change has to come from Africans, and Americans can do it for us. And that is what we need, institutions to help us do this in Africa. Now, remember what, you know, Albert Einstein said. Insanity is defined as doing the same thing again and again and again and again and expecting different results. By now, we should know that doing the same thing again is not going to give us the different results that we wanted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, George. As a reminder, please use the white cards to write out your questions, and we'll pass those up. Or you can tweet us at EconomicClubIN. So I'll go ahead and get us started. We have about 10 minutes left for questions. What two or three countries in Africa would you consider to have the most stable governments and serve as good examples for other nations on the continent?
Oh, boy. Well, there are some success stories on the continent. Number one, there is Botswana, and then there is Mauritius, and then there's Cape Verde Islands, and then some people might pick Rwanda, but I don't like, the government in Rwanda is not very stable. But then, you know, you'll notice something. Those countries that I picked, they're all small countries. And this is what is very disturbing about Africa. Botswana, Cape Verde Islands, Mauritius, they are small countries. In other words, the small countries don't have the locomotive heft to pull the rest of the continent out of its economic miasma. You know, we want countries like Nigeria, Zimbabwe, Ethiopia, you know, the big countries, Sudan, to be doing well. But the little countries that I've mentioned are good enough.
Okay. Next question is, how do you balance donors' desire to fund certain productive projects with recipients' belief that those projects are not what is needed?
Well, I think we need to rethink the whole idea about foreign aid in the active involvement of the donor countries, because the problem that we have in Africa relates more to governments. Our governments have been totally dysfunctional. And therefore, you know, if using aid, the government-to-government aid programs that we had in the past, what that does is to strengthen and bolster the notion that it's government that have to develop the economies. Whereas, you know, we should be placing more emphasis on the private sector. So this is a problem for the aid paradigm.
Has there been any progress towards the development of an independent judiciary in Africa which would help combat the government corruption and establish rule of law?
Well, this is why, you know, when President Obama came to Ghana in 2009, he made a statement which we all sort of embrace. He said, Africa doesn't need strong men. What Africa needs are strong institutions. We said, wow. But unfortunately, he hasn't followed through to push that. And this is why corruption has gotten completely out of control in Africa, because we haven't been able to enforce the rule of law. Take Nigeria, for example. Between 1970 and 2004, more than $450 billion flowed into Nigeria's government coffers. But then Nigeria's kamikaze, you know, bandits, you know, stole most of it. $412 billion, they stole most of it. And this is why Nigeria is an oil-producing country, and yet doesn't have gasoline. And this past February, the governor of the Bank of Nigeria told the president that $50 billion in oil revenue is missing. Guess what the president did? The president sacked the governor who reported this on charges of financial mismanagement and recklessness. It was incredible.
What is the role of the church in a free Africa?
This is a tough question because, first of all, Christianity and Islam are not indigenous to Africa. So one has to be very careful in when you talk about church and mosque in Africa, because if you look at Nigeria right now, Nigeria is being torn apart by Boko Haram. Boko Haram is an Islamic terrorist group which claims that birthing education is a sin. So we have to be extremely careful in terms of the churches could play a role. In fact, they did play a role in, say, Rwanda during the genocide. They sort of welcomed those victims who were running away from the murderers and gave them shelter and sanctuary. Also, the mosques have also done the same thing in Ivory Coast. And so, sure, they have a role to play, but at the same time, it's a role that does not, you know, supersede those of the government in these countries, because it's a very, very delicate balance that we have to keep in Africa.
Time for one more question. We would like to invest in Africa to help develop the local capabilities and create value, but we have had difficulty with corruption. What recommendations do you have?
I would say that stay away from governments. If you want to help Africa, for every African country, you have three. Every African economy has three sectors. There is the modern sector. The modern sector is the abode of the elites. And it is also the seat of government. And the modern sector is centered around the urban areas. That's the modern sector. And then you have the rural sector. The rural sector, you find that in the countryside. And stuck in between is what you call the informal sector. The vast majority of the people in Africa, the poor, can be found in the informal and the traditional sectors. That's where you find them. The problem with Africa is the modern sector. The modern sector is collapsing. The modern sector is where power is, and that's where you have all the struggle for power. And the struggle for power sometimes spills over into the informal and the traditional sectors. Now, if you want to invest in Africa, the two sectors that I would recommend would be the informal sector and also the traditional sector. The traditional sector is where you have agriculture. And the informal sector is where you have things like bakery, bicycle repair, scooters, and so forth. So those are the two areas. If you want to avoid the government, if you go into the modern sector, then that's where you run into these, what I call the vampire elites.
Please help me thanking George for coming today and speaking. I appreciate his thoughts.